really betrays the institution of the melucha, of the monarchy. He betrays his father, and ultimately he really betrays himself in terms of what he might have been, what he should have been, and ultimately, you know, what his what his legacy was. And the last pieces that we were discussing last year, and it's perfectly acceptable after so many weeks away from Lachem and doing other things to need the review, I certainly do myself. Shlomo violated all three of the Torah level restrictions that pertain to the king. He had too much money for himself. He had too many horses, and it did affiliate him in an inappropriate way with Mitzrayim. And then he had too many wives. Just to give a, to go back over some of the statistics, because maybe this, helps capture it a little bit. The Torah level limit, the way that we understand, it's a three-way dispute amongst the Tanaim, but the way that we understand is that a king can have no more than 18 wives, which again, from our point of view, doesn't sound overly restrictive, but it is novel in the sense that, according to Torah law, no other Jewish male carries such as a restriction. There's no Torah level restriction against anybody else having more than, let's say, 18 wives, though the Torah doesn't recommend it, and maybe in a lot of different ways, narratively speaking, the Torah condemns it and lets a person know that they'll be asking for trouble. But as a matter of pure halacha, it's not prohibited. Just like a person isn't prohibited from having too much money, or a person isn't prohibited from having too many horses. Again, we wouldn't give this person the Hatznei Alecha Sim Elokecha award, but at the same time, you wouldn't be able to say that they were violating an Isser D'oraisa per se. But for the king, they really are, and Shlomo violated all of these. And when it came to the wives, Shlomo had 700 wives and another 300 pilagshim, concubines. A machlokas between the Rambam and the Ravid, whether a pilagish would go to the count. The Rambam is of the view that the answer to that question is affirmative. The Ravid is very skeptical of that point. But be that as it may, he was at least 682 above the limit, if not 982. So once you get into that level of multiples, it's like getting pulled over in the 25 zone and you're going 200 miles an hour. It's not really like you were close. It's saying like, the police officer says, "Do you know how fast you were going?" And you say, "Really? I was speeding. It kind of felt like I was 25." So, it's obviously something egregious that Shlomo got involved in. And, even though the simple reading of the psukim, as we discussed, is that Shlomo even became involved in Avodah Zarah per se, which Chazal had a hard time, not just Chazal, but even the Abravanel, who more often than not is willing to go with the simple interpretation, but the Abravanel thinks that's a bridge too far. To say that Shlomo really became involved in idolatry is quite shocking. But what he says, the point is that the Navi can put it that way because his permissiveness and his laxity with respect to what his wives were doing, especially given where he ought to have been as the king, as the son of David HaMelech, as the scion of that dynasty, it's a big enough indictment, and so the punishment. Anybody just want to review for us what the punishment that Shlomo is given, though admittedly not in his own lifetime, but what does God tell him? This is literally the last point that we covered. What's going to happen?
His children will not have full control of the malchus over the whole earth.
So. Yeah, right. So it's the loss of his fumbling away of his father's legacy, which, again, for Shlomo and everything we spoke about last year, David, my father, right, and everything that was meant to entail and his whole life mission of completing his father's dreams. So his fumbling that away, right, materially, is a failure, a terrible failure. Effie, as you point out, God says, you know, because of my attachment to David and his fealty to me, I'm not going to completely destroy the Davidic line. You know, you'll retain one tribe, you'll retain Yerushalayim, at least for a time. But it's hard to overstate the calamity of, you know, Shlomo's, you know, failure. The Medrash tells us that there's a Mishnah at the end of Masech the Sanhedrin, Perek HaChelek, where it says that there are a number of kings who, through their actions, forfeited their portion in the world to come. Yeravam, who we'll talk about extensively next week, is like the first on the list. And Achav is on the list, another very wicked person. And there's discussion about Menashe. Menashe was a particularly wicked king who came later in the Davidic line. But the Medrash says that Shlomo belongs on that list. And that when David saw this, David, you know, basically, you know, threw himself in front of the Kisei HaKavod. He threw himself in front of the divine throne because it was just too much to bear, this idea that his son, you know, could be grouped with such ignominious characters. But again, we have to understand how Shlomo personally unraveled and how that led to the unraveling of not just, like I say, you know, his father's legacy, but in a very significant way, you know, derailed Jewish history. It's a margula b'fumayhu, the Chazal. Chazal always referred to together Yimei David and Yimei Shlomo as the high watermark of Jewish history. One halachic expression of this idea is that the Gemara Nivamos tells us that during the days of David and Shlomo, they either didn't or were very skeptical of accepting converts. Lohayu mekablam gerim. It's a debate whether that means really entirely or at least for the most part, because that was like a time when the Jewish people were really, you know, on top, so to speak, geopolitically, socioeconomically, and otherwise. And there were real questions about why people were motivated to convert. I guess, you know, one of the blessings of our oppression throughout our history is if somebody wanted to convert, you know, we typically, you know, didn't have to say, are you doing this like to be on the winning team? That was not, you know, the typical arrangement in Galuyot Yisrael Leminehem, in our various diasporas. At least that was, you know, one purpose of the you know, of the history that we endured. But the point being that Yimei David and Yimei Shlomo are the high water mark, and the basic premise of tonight's shiur, and in some ways this will be our, you know, an archetype for the next 4 or 5 months, you know, leading to Pesach, would be this exact point, that the failure of Shlomo and what it caused in terms of the schism of the Jewish people, the division of the kingdom, can not only be seen in terms of like a generational failure, like, you know, he missed an opportunity, but it really is a cosmic disaster for the Jewish people. And the unraveling, though it begins slowly, and as we'll see today, peripherally, really very much at the margins, the unraveling, as they call it, is inexorably linked back to Shlomo's failure. So, again, I don't think there's any way to overstate just how, you know, grievous a blow this was to the Jewish people. Shlomo really was gifted something very precious by David, and le'es ziknaso, his fumbling of it, is something that, again, you know, really cost the Jewish people in a very, very significant way. And we can trace so much of what follows in terms of Jewish history to Shlomo's failure in this regard. So let me share my screen, and then I want to read some psukim together and show the beginning of the process of unraveling, and then to discuss some of these elements as I see them. Just 1 second. Just one second. It says that I have to just restart the meeting to share a screen. So just apologize. Let me just get restarted, and then I'll be able to share my screen. Just one second. Okay. Okay, Elisheva, you can see the screen, right? It's working. Okay, perfect. Okay. Okay, so this is where we left off. We're in Perek Yud Aleph, Psukim Yud Dalet through Chafei, which I'd like to go through now systematically. So Vayakim Adonai Satan Lishlomo et Hadad Hadomi. Mizera Hamelech Ube'edom. So here you have this really interesting, call like a split screen. Shlomo is going to be opposed, the first Satan of the three Satanim, the first antagonist, if you will, is named Hadad Hadumi, and he is the scion of the line of Esav, who Esav of Yedom. So you think about this, this is now like sort of holding Yaakov and Esav. So Hadad, Esav, is brought back to sort of trouble Yaakov. Vayibios David esedom balos Yoav sarat zaval lekaver sachalalim. Let's pause here. David had a major war with Edom, and he sent Yoav back to bury the enemy dead. This was considered, Chazal, I'll talk about this at great length, this like very profound act of humanity, very unusual for the time. It was at the time when David had waged a war of near annihilation against Edom, Bayachol Zachar Be'edom, but there was still this like aspect of humanity. Just wanted to reiterate something from Sefer Shmuel that we talked about a lot in years past. Remember that David is the one that cuts the Nesinim, the Givonim, off from ever entering into the Jewish people for this exact sin, for exposure of the human body when they killed the seven descendants of the house of Shaul. So it's a point of great sensitivity in David's life. Want to again emphasize that David was, you know, greatly, greatly impressed by the people who lived in Yavesh Gilad. Those individuals, the people of Yavesh Gilad, had rescued the body of Shaul from the Plishtim. So this is like a motif through David's life. The dignity, Kvod Hames. It's really interesting. There's a medrash, just apropos this point, it seems somewhat tangential, that David's family was massacred in Moab when Shaul was after them, and that the bodies may have been defiled as well. So again, there's a lot of literature surrounding David HaMelech, the issue of Kavod Hames. Okay, because Yisheshes Chadashim Yashav Sham Yoav V'Chol Yisrael Adi Chris Kol Zachar Be'edom V'Irach Adad Hu V'Anashim Adomim Me'avdei Aviv Yitol Levo Mitzrayim V'Adad Nar Katan. So this is going way back in Jewish history. So this Hadad, also known as Adad, was a very young boy when he fled Edom, and he took refuge in Mitzrayim. So just if somebody can, as we go through this story, tell me like what it reminds you of. I personally don't think it's that subtle. Vayakumim Midian, so they come from Midian. Vayavo Paran, vayikchu anashim imam miParan. They pick up some stragglers along the way. Vayavo Mitzrayim, el Paro melch Mitzrayim. Vayitein lo bayis velechem, amar lo veeretz nasan lo. So what happens is that he gives him a house, he gives him bread, he gives him land, right? Paro, you know, takes him in with, you know, incredible generosity. Even gives him a wife. This is literally the sister of the queen. The queen of Egypt at the time was a woman named Tachpanes. So again, he's like a brother-in-law of the king. It's unbelievable to imagine that kind of like a meteoric rise. Achos Tachpanes as Genuvas Beno. Okay, and then there's this child, right, from Hadad and his wife. And the child is raised and nursed, Vatigmaleu Tachpanes, Besoch Bes Paro, and nursed by the queen, Vaihi Genuvas Bes Paro, Besoch Bene Faro. And this child was being raised as a royal heir. Then, Vadad Shama B'Mitzrayim, Kishachav David Mavosav. That Hadad hears that David, who had, you know, slaughtered Edom, he ran away from as a young boy, he hears that David is dead. V'chimes Yoav Saratzava, and Yoav, the you know, the general, the conquering general, is also no longer alive. Ayomer Hadad el Paro, Shalcheni ve'elech el Artsi. So he says, you know, I want to go to, you know, my land, my people. So Paro says, really? Are you serious? Vayomer lo Paro, ma ata chaser yimi? Why in the world would you do that? Vinach mevakesh alechas al artzecha. Vayomer lo ki shalech tishalachem. He says, no, right? I want you to send me. So Paro says, well, you know, you have everything here. You're basically a member of the royal house. You are. You know, economically, all your needs are provided for, and you want to go to this backwater, you know, to Edom. And the answer is yes. Okay, so before we go any further, you know, so the story of Hadad is basically a version of which story? All of Navi, reiterations. You have somebody being raised in the house of Paro, and this shocking desire to want to identify with, you know, with a fallen and oppressed people, and Paro can't understand it. Paro has given him everything, given him a home, an adopted life.
Oh, sure.
Right. So this is... Effie, was that you?
Yeah, that was me.
Okay, good job. Okay. So...
I was waiting for other people to chime in.
Okay, no, it's fine. It's fine, you know. So this is a version of the Moshe story. It's really interesting.
I thought when it started at first, and you were saying about taking refuge in Mitzrayim and Paro giving him a wife, at first, I thought that was a little bit reminiscent of Yosef. And then it shifted gears to Moshe. So then I was a little bit confused.
Yeah, no, I happen to agree that there are elements of both. It may be somewhat selective of me, but just the Moshe element is the one that I find most fascinating, Ruthie, because to me, that's the Navi's way of saying that, okay, we're going back to the beginning. And instead of Shlomo continuing on this process that began with Moshe, 40 years in the desert, and then, of course, 14 years in Gilgal, and 369 years in Shiloh, and 57 in Ovan Givon, and finally, you know, David HaMelech, and building the Beis HaMikdash. So God says, you know, I can play back the script, but I can flip it. I can flip it on you. And I can take, you know, the most unlikely of characters, this refugee child raised in the house of Paro, who, you know, in a completely unpredictable way, gives up all earthly power to identify with his people, you know, and his homeland. I can employ that same story, that same motif, to unravel the Jewish people's history. If that was, you know, the sort of the beginning of the Yeshua of the Jewish people, the beginning of our salvation is in this story. So the beginning of our unraveling is in this story. God can play back the script and he can flip it on us. And I think, Ruthie, as far as this goes, right, you see the sense of like trenchant critique here of Shlomo, right? Because Shlomo is somebody who abandoned his people materially for all of the Goyim, right? All of these foreign women from, you know, from Moab and from Mitzrayim in particular, and from all over, and, you know, became this international cosmopolitan figure and betrays his father and betrays the Jewish people in that respect. And he's going to be opposed. His Satan is somebody who, you know, as far as this issue is concerned, has much greater credentials than he has, who is loyal to his people, who is loyal to his homeland. Well, Shlomo is busy trying, you know, to be this international, you know, figure with wives, you know, from, you know, all over the ancient Near East. So I think that that, too, is this, you know, extremely profound critique as well. Then the psukim go on and tell us that Hadad joined forces with the second antagonist, the second Satan. Vayakem Elohim lo Satan et Rizon ben Elyada sher Barach, also a refugee, Me'ez Hadadezer Melech Tzova Adonav, okay, that he ran away from the king of Tzova, right, the king, there's Aram Tzova, and Aram Narayim, so this is the near Aram, the Aram of Syria. Vayikpotz alav anashim, vayihi sar gedud barog David Osam, vayichu Damesek, vayeshuva vayimlechu b'damesek. Okay, so he gathers people to himself, people who had, again, become refugees when David, you know, David led the capture of Aram Tzova. It's what Chazal referred to as a kibush yachid. David should have first conquered other parts of Israel. It's a mistake in terms of the chronology. In any event, so he sets up a little melucha for himself in Damascus. The Abravanel thinks that Rizon ben Eliada would not have been able to achieve this without the alliance of Hadad. Vahi satan l'Yisrael kol yimei shlomo v'sara asher Hadad. That's the linchpin phrase for the Abravanel, that Hadad and Rizon ben Eliada are really like this kind of a team. Vayakots b'Yisrael, vayimloch al Aram. Aram, which had been a vassal state that brought mincha to David and subsequently to Shlomo, now you know, is in open rebellion against the Jewish people. And these are, this is the beginning, right? These are the two satanim, the two antagonists. One, Hadad. The second, Rizon, one from Edom initially, one from, you know, a refugee from Aram Tzova, who finds his way back to Damascus, finds his way back to that location. They join forces and they begin to sort of snip at the, you know, at the edges, so to speak, of Shlomo's monarchy. The Abravanel here, I just want to read this line inside. When it says Vayakots b'Yisrael, he says Kotzim l'Yisrael v'tzninim b'tzidam, that kind of thorns in the side of the Jewish people. So the point that I wanted to make here is that the unraveling really begins very slowly and admittedly, like very peripherally, right? This isn't an attack on the Beis Hamikdash. This isn't an attack on Yerushalayim. This isn't even an attack on Yisrael. This is literally at the periphery of the kingdom. What happened? Through the combined forces of Hadad and Rizon, these nobodies, essentially, these refugees, Aram is lost as a, you know, as a vassal state. So the Navi seems to be going out of its way to say that, look, it wasn't like, you know, this happened all at once. It started very much, you know, peripheral. It was some outer province, the outermost reaches of Malchus Shlomo. It was lost. Secondly, as I just alluded to, it wasn't like, you know, these figures were Nebuchadnezzar, you know, titans of the ancient world. This is not Sancheriv, this is not Nebuchadnezzar, this is not, you know, this is not somebody of, you know, this is not Alexander the Great. Okay, we're talking about people who are, you know, relatively secondary figures, you know, as far as that's concerned. And yet, right, they're able to, you know, sort of be a thorn in Shlomo's side. And that, too, you know, I think is a very significant, very, very significant point. That Shlomo, you know, who, again, his self-perception is as this, you know, international figure, international man of wisdom, right? So God says, you know, I can, you know, undo you, you know, 1,000, you know, cuts at a time. So it seems particularly significant that he's being undermined by people that, you know, nobody would have expected in this respect to, you know, rise up against a king like Shlomo, who was, you know, in control of the entire region in such a powerful way economically and otherwise. So again, it doesn't start with the Beis Hamikdash, it doesn't start with Yerushalayim, it doesn't start with, you know, Eretz Yisrael becoming under attack. It's a relatively obscure province. You know, the loss of Aram as a vassal state. Second of all, it doesn't start out with, you know, Shlomo meeting, you know, some Goliath, right? Nebuchadnezzar, Sennacherib, or whatever. We're talking about secondary figures. But ultimately, God says, I can undo you with secondary figures. I can, find people, who come from the most unlikely places, you know, who were refugees, both of them. Well, this is the last point that we'll get to, from your father, right? When your father destroyed Edom, this was a young boy who ran away. When your father went to war, subsequently in Damascus, this Rizon was a refugee, and they find each other, and somehow, right, these are sort of the leftovers, the vestiges of what David conquered. So those little pieces now begin to crawl back and begin to unwind Shlomo's Malchus, as if to say, right, your father's work was left unfinished. Instead of finishing your father's work, you reversed it, and now that unfinished work, the refugees, the survivors of your father's wars, are going to come back and begin your unraveling. So, like I say, the fact that the Hadad story in particular is the Moshe story, but not in favor of the Jewish people, against the Jewish people, I mean, is the single strongest point of evidence that what we're really talking about is a major unraveling. It's a very significant unraveling. It's going to cut to the entire arc of Jewish history that was triggered by Moshe, and by the end of it, with the schism, with the what eventually results in terms of the destruction of the house of David, essentially, right, the Beis Hamikdash and the exile of the Jewish people. The Ramban, in particular, writes about this with great passion, that Bayis Sheni was nothing compared to Bayis Rishon, based on the Gemara and Yoma, but that it was not in any way a reconstitution of what the Jewish people experienced in the days of David and Shlomo. That will have to wait for Yemos HaMashiach. That is to say that this is the pivot point in Jewish history, and Shlomo's fumbling of the line that goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu is really, really, really consequential. Therefore, God brings in this, you know, Hadad character to start the story, in a very unlikely way, for somebody who is adopted into the home of Paro. And then to strike out, you know, against Shlomo with the help of this other refugee, Rizon. And again, it doesn't, you know, come to the inner core right away, but eating away at the periphery. One last point, you know, just in terms of the Mida Keneged Mida, and I'm sure this wasn't lost on anybody, but we talked about Shlomo's many wives, Nashav HaRabot, extensively. The chief villain amongst them, without any doubt, was of course Bas Paro, right? There's no question about that. To refer back to one detail from a number of months ago, remember David HaMelech had left a certain space undeveloped in Yerushalayim for the Ole Regalim, and Shlomo turned that into some kind of a condominium for Bas Paro. You know, it's like the ultimate, you know, right, the people were holding protests at the zoning, you know, planning committee meeting. You know, you're going to do this with the Milo, you know, you're going to turn it into condominium for Bas Paro. You know, is money everything in this world? So, the fact is, right, that God now takes the new Bas Paro, and turns her into the mother of this villain, you know, of, Hadad. Who was taken into the house of Paro and was able to, you know, become part of that royal line. So the unraveling begins from the very place, like the ground zero of Shlomo's chet, of his involvement with Bas Paro. And it's not meant to be subtle. And it's this idea that, you know, you can't outrun, you know, these kinds of things. So, God willing, what we'll take a look at next week is what I call, sort of moving from the periphery to the epicenter, moving from Hadad and Rizon, who are obviously not Jewish figures and don't threaten, as we spoke about, Israel per se. They threaten the outer reaches of the kingdom, right, from Mitzrayim up to Damascus, etc., the margins of the kingdom, the loss of Aram Tzova. So then next week we'll talk about Yeravam and what Yeravam represents in terms of now the moving from the periphery to the epicenter in terms of the third Satan, the third great antagonist to Shlomo, and how this will, you know, plague Shlomo for the rest of his life, and then come to, you know, really a pressure point after Shlomo's passing in the days of Rechavam, his son, and ultimately the loss, you know, of David's legacy, the loss of the unified Jewish people in the city of Yerushalayim. So Yeravam represents a very important escalation in terms of this, you know, scale of Satanim from the periphery to the epicenter. We'll talk about who Yeravam is and what Yeravam represents, the way that he's portrayed as like the ultimate insider, you know, as far as Shlomo was concerned, and how that's able to erode and eventually really like explode, you know, entire Malchus that David had built up and handed off to Shlomo with such great expectations. So, you know, we're building up, of course, here to the schism of the Jewish people, from which the Jewish people, as I think, you know, we tried to highlight today, you know, have never recovered. You know, the question within Chazal is, will we ever recover in terms of the northern tribes, the Aseres HaShvatim? Very fascinating question. But this was, you know, the high water mark. This was the moment when the Jewish people could have, you know, achieved a kind of like a beatitude, a national beatitude. And Shlomo, in his, you know, hedonism, his narcissism, violated all of the mitzvos HaMelech. The only question is to what degree, and the consequences. Like I say, it wasn't as if, you know, during Bayis Sheni, okay, we got the Beis Hamikdash back. It was a fraction of the Jewish people. It was, and like I say, the Ramban, you know, makes no bones about that. So, you know, for us, it's a very challenging thing because of all of Shlomo's accomplishments and, you know, the great promise that he had. But, you know, as we said, the Medrash, which says that Shlomo really does, in some level, belong on the list with Yeravam, with Achav, with Menashe, with the great villains of Jewish history. It's harsh on the one hand because his sins don't really compare, but on the other hand, you know, the loss of the potential is something unprecedented in Jewish history. Asher chamolo niyasa v'chamolo sosif, in terms of what Shlomo was handed, in terms of the potential of the one who built the Beis Hamikdash, and then you know, the loss of that being, to this point, unmitigated, and perhaps if Chazal, you know, if that view is normative, that those tribes are lost forever, it represents an irreparable, you know, breach in Klal Yisrael and Shiftei Ka. The loss of 5/6 of the Jewish people, 10 of the 12 tribes, is an unfathomable. You know, we talk about decimation, that literally means 1 out of 10. This is, we're talking about the inverse of that fraction. So again, Shlomo bears that historic responsibility, that historical responsibility, you know, the agents of divine destruction range from these peripheral figures, Hadad and Rizon, to what we'll see next week, you know, which is, you know, a much more, you know, internal candidate. Somebody very much on the inside of all of the action, Yeravam ben Nevad, a critical figure, you know, in Jewish history, and God willing, we'll pick it up there next week. So it's great to be back. I want to welcome everybody back. I want to welcome some of the new people as well, mostly returnees, but also some new people as well, and really just so much looking forward to this Limud this year that we have till the end of Sefer Melachim Aleph. You know, Shlomo and Yeravam, and you know, the epoch of Eliyahu Hanavi. There's just so much to be excited about to cover this year. So God willing, we should have a lot of success together, and we'll see everybody a week from tonight.